Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, thanks for downloading the Third Coast podcast, I'm Dennis Funk. We've just added a brand new story to our audio library over at thirdcoastfestival.org and I hope you head over there and have a listen. It's called An American Life, the story of Von Hood, who was a 118-pound barber when he was drafted into the Vietnam War. While you're there, be sure to read our behind-the-scenes interview with producer Erica Heilman, who formerly had my dream job of private investigator. Alright, that's it from me. Now, here's a brand new episode of ReSound.
From the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago, I'm Gwen Maxey, and this is ReSound. ReSound is a remix of music, documentaries, found sound, sound bites, and playlists we find all over the world. We listen to everything we can get our ears on, then play you the best of what we hear each week on ReSound. This week, we're featuring the musical documentaries of Alan Hall, founder of Falling Tree Productions. Alan first came to our attention when he sent us this back in 2005.
Is this the real life? Cause I'm easy come, easy go.
Little high, little low.
Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter to me.
Good, let's go. 1, 2, 3, 4.
That mashup of Bohemian Rhapsody continues for another 12 minutes, and it only gets better. Alan has produced dozens of musical portraits of all styles since then, and they're always delightfully out of the ordinary. Today, we bring you two examples. A sound portrait of Ellie Stone, best known for her role in Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, and the story of Jeff Buckley, a shy musician with a powerhouse of a voice who tragically died at the height of his popularity. Listening to Alan Hall's documentary about Jeff Buckley was the first I'd ever heard of the singer. But now I am totally enthralled. To me, his voice was powerful at a near whisper and a tsunami at full throttle. Here is the grace of Jeff Buckley.
I think it was probably around the 27th of December, I got a phone call from one of my flatmates to tell me that there was the sexiest voice she had ever heard on our answer machine of some guy called Jeff who wanted to meet me for lunch. And she said in no uncertain terms, if I didn't meet him, she was going.
My name's Steve Abbott. I'm also known as Abbo in the rock and roll world. And I'm looking back on a day 20 years ago when Jeff Buckley was in London on the day of the release of his first EP, Live at Chenet.
So I'm Emma Banks and I'm an agent at Creative Artists Agency in London now. And in 1993-94, I was a very junior agent at a company called Wasted Talent. How old would I have been? 24? 25? Jeff was staying in the UK over Christmas and we'd been in contact and he said he was going to be around and, you know, could we meet up? I was like, yeah, sure, of course we can. I still had no idea what he looked like at this point. I'd never seen a picture of him, but we agreed to meet and he said, I'll be wearing a hat and I look like a musician. So I was waiting at the restaurant and in he walked and it was obvious that he was a rock star.
It's a song about a dream.
I fed him. He ate duck. I remember that. And we just chatted. We chatted about his life, his family, his music, his aspirations.
It's about the music, stupid. It was like, let the music do the talking. I'm Dave Laurie, and I was the manager of Jeff Buckley.
You know, it was at that point that he said to me he didn't ever want to play any big venues. He wanted to keep it small.
He wanted to play bookstores, things like that.
That laid down the gauntlet for me. So I was like, okay, if you want small gigs, I'm going to find you small gigs.
It just was a matter of building it one fan at a time.
Well, I'm lying in my bed, the blanket is warm. This body will never be safe from harm. Still feel your hair, black ribbons of coal. Touch my skin, keep me whole.
We did not push his good looks. We did not push his father at all. We didn't do TV shows. In fact, we turned down Saturday Night Live in America. We turned away soundtracks in movies.
I'll tell you what I have got. I've got a tape that he did. When we started, nobody knew who he was, and loads of people thought it was rubbish. So Jeff did an interview, I think it was in some truck stop somewhere, that we recorded and we put it on cassette tape, and we were going to send it out to people.
Hey. That's Scampi?
Yeah, that's me.
That's you. Anything else I can get you right now?
More coke?
Okay.
My fantasy of Europe is very, very romantic. Extremely. Because it's the old country, you know. It's where most Americans descend from. You know, or Europe is white America's roots.
He really wanted to go overseas. He said a few times that it was an escapism. He could just go up on stage. He could walk down the street. He could, you know, enjoy the different cultures.
Like, it's not hard to put across the concept of a guy singing in a pub. As it is, like, people were shocked that I came into their coffee houses. People were shocked that I came into their cafes.
All right, I'll be right out with your soup in a minute.
And saying, like, wow, I didn't...
How is everything so far?
It's great so far.
Good. Thank you.
So this is however old it is now, 20 years old. I do sometimes listen to it. I do have that.
Being on the road is, it's a, for me, and every single performance, it's new. Every performance will be new till the day I die, because people are completely different from day to day. And being on the road is so romantic.
The day started having breakfast, Jeff and my family. He was brilliant at mimicking anything, not just music. And I remember he kept my daughter Hope very much amused with his Disney impressions. We had a photo shoot with Kevin Westerberg at midday. We had a GLR session at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that night he had his first proper London gig at Bunge's Folk Club in Soho.
I'm Kevin Westerberg, photographer at large. And I'm digging out the old photos from March 18th, 1994, which was my one and only proper photo shoot with him. I developed man love for him quite quickly. There's something so perfectly structured about his face that it was important to kind of create this sort of mood. I haven't looked at these in a while, but there's some great stuff of him on the sofa with a kind of Kafkan Indian drape over it. When he got the guitar in his hand, then he started actually playing, and he started to become even more himself. I think he's kind of cradling the guitar there, and actually nurturing it, maybe.
When I met him that Christmas, he'd been given the numbers of the people at Sony in the UK to see if maybe they'd like to meet him, and not one of them returned his phone call. History gets rewritten, and I think all the way up to that sort of, you know, that March trip, Loads of people didn't get it. Loads of people didn't understand it.
So when I saw Jeff play live with just a guitar and see him, and this was New York, and just silence an audience, you could hear a pin drop. I've never seen an artist do that before. So just putting him up there naked on a stage with a guitar and let that voice, it was so fun on that first tour, just watching people just, their jaws drop. They'd be reading a book and I was look up and they're going, oh my God, you know, it was that way.
There were a little bunch of us that were believers, but it only took a few of us to be really passionate to get the word out.
Yeah, Jeff was on a bit of a high after the photo shoot. We were on our way to GLR Radio. This was the first day that Jeff's record was out. To say he was excited was an understatement. You know, he had a lot to say, really, and this was his first proper British interview. But unfortunately, on this day, there was really bad traffic due to a crash in Baker Street. So to pass away the time, I said to Jeff, this isn't the programme that you're about to go and do. And that was really a big mistake, because as soon as we turned it on, the DJ was front announcing Jeff's performance by mentioning in that she had Tim Buckley's son coming into a session. She didn't even mention the word Jeff. Everything was Tim Buckley's son, Tim Buckley's son. Jeff eventually lost his rag and, wearing those big black boots, kicked the radio. And the face of the radio literally split in two. And it was shocking for me, because this very quiet, introverted musician that I got to know over the last few weeks, I suddenly saw a whole different side to him. And I didn't really understand the relationship with his dad and the complication of that. And we both went silent. As soon as we walked in, the producer said, ah, so you've bothered to turn up. The irony of this was GLR had all these traffic reports talking about Baker Street, so they would have known why we were late. So we walked in this very, very frosty atmosphere, and I saw them push the record button to tape the session. And Jeff was, I don't want it taped. I don't want to be here. And he wanted to walk out. Of course, it was only a bit of an artistic strop.
Well, we're really happy to say that Jeff Buckley has managed to get here. A bit of a problem with the traffic, I think, which I think everyone can identify who lives in London. Jeff has just finished his first album, Live at Chiney, and he joins me in the studio now. Hello.
Hey.
Thank you very much for coming in. You're signed to Big Cat Records.
And Jeff sat there almost sulking, and I still wasn't sure that he was going to play. Anyway, he answered the usual questions, very sort of tautly and without much grace, to use a pun.
There's no rules but yours. You know.
I suppose the way to do it is not to be afraid of the record company, because I suppose if they say, we want you to do this, and you say no, there must be a certain amount of fear that you think, oh, they might ditch me.
They have their opinions, but I'm the one that makes the work, so...
Is that quite unusual, do you think?
No, it shouldn't be unusual. But the people I'm with are pretty cool. I mean, I like them.
I think you're very lucky. OK, what are you going to play for me?
A song. Called Grace.
Jeff just naturally had that it factor. He walked into a room and it just lit up. His personality, his aloofness. We used to have a saying that if you're trying to talk to a woman, you would grab a Jeff Buckley Grace record and you would say, here's what I mean to say.
And he was different to most artists at the time. It was very uncool at the time to talk about influences. Jeff wore his influences on his sleeve. You knew that his favourite artist was Liz Fraser of Cocteau Twins. You knew that his favourite guitarist was Jimmy Page.
What people don't realise about Jeff Buckley, he was a really great guitar player.
And it set its sights on people like Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, who had a spiritual element to the music, that they reached a place with their music. And actually that performance of Grace at GLR was probably the closest I ever saw him reaching that place.
His voice would just do it to you.
There's the moon passing to stay long enough for the clouds to fly me away. But my time coming, I'm not afraid to die.
He knew how to work a room in the sense with his voice. There was just this rawness that just would come out of him. Something about his childhood. I only asked once and he said, I really don't want to get into it. I think there was this shy kid who held his emotions inside. And I think music was his only outlet to let that out.
This was Jeff Buckley, for the first time, really making an impression. And he just went for it. I couldn't believe he'd sustain it. I was expecting his voice to go, or him to lose his way on the guitar, but he didn't. It just built and built and built. The DJ's chin hit the table. She was so awestruck. And I feel hands around my name. Was so easy to know and forget with this kiss. Well, I'm not afraid to go, but it goes so silly.
It's a real sort of emotional roller coaster there. That's Jeff Buckley live in the studio and a number called Grace. Musically in the song, I mean, it's just so varied. I mean, there's everything in there. And it's obviously a real performance for him. I mean, he looked quite exhausted at the end of the song.
No, I was just getting a lot of anger out.
Yeah.
Something happened on the way.
So you're sort of screaming your anger out.
And for him, as soon as he finished the song, you could feel a whole wave of release sort of pass over his shoulders and head into the studio. And everybody just went, oh, wow.
One thing that comes out very clearly from that is that you have a massive vocal range.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, did you have to work on that, or was it just natural?
Ever since I was a kid, I had a pretty high voice. Like, people would call up the house and think I was my mother. And I got very self-conscious about that, so I would do things, you know, whiskey and stuff. It was always very musical. I mean, it was basically just me and my mom.
What kind of stuff were you listening to when you were sort of growing up?
When I was
up?
A kid?
Yeah.
Well, when I was a kid, I knew like a bunch of like Spanish children's songs, like Mi mano hijo lindo y blanco yo, and all that, you know. And then growing up, like all the pop at the time was pretty stinking awesome. You know, like Stevie Wonder and the Doobie Brothers and all those stuff. Joni, lots of tons and tons and tons and tons of Joni Mitchell.
With women musicians, be it Marianne Faithfull, Chrissy Hynde, Debbie Harry, these were all people that he gravitated to. Liz Frazier. He loved women, or he wanted to be loved by women. It might be more what I'm talking about. And I think that's evident when you listen to Grace. You hear this voice that's just wanting to be accepted.
There was something just so endearing about Jeff. I think if he got you and if he felt a connection, you got all of him quite quickly.
My whole philosophy or my whole discovery is that every emotion has a sound to it, you know. So I just don't want to be kept away from anything I want to say.
And I remember my daughter Hope, she came to a couple of the dates with me at the time, and she was about 2.5, 3 years old. And Jeff actually sat her on stage, so she sat underneath him Sunday lunchtime in Hitchin. And he actually bent down once and asked her what song she would like. And she said Colours of the Wind from Pocahontas. And he sung it.
We played a pub in Hitchin, which I think was called The Sun. My parents live quite close to Hitchin. And so I said to my mum and dad, well, you know, why don't you come? You can see this artist. I think he's amazing. He loved the idea of family and of closeness and of being nurtured. She is the tear that hangs inside my soul forever. The first act that I think my parents really liked, and that made a difference. And my mum and Jeff got really close. She would come to gigs occasionally. I remember we played at the Cambridge Junction. I turned up, and the first thing Jeff went was, "Where's mum?" And he referred to my mother as mum. Well,
there. Jeff Buckley is in the studio with me, and that was Lover, You Should Have Come Over. That was really fantastic.
Thank you
ever so much for coming, and I really enjoyed that. It's fantastic. If you missed Jeff last night at the garage, you can see him tonight at Bunges, and I just think you should get down there because it was
Bunges.
Bunges, yes. Looking forward to that, aren't you?
Jump on over.
GLR presents live. So we're in Bunges.
It was an arch. I assume it would have been under a music shop. It's not there anymore.
It's a bomb shelter. It has a domed roof made of brick.
It was tiny. It was 80 capacity, probably.
And there was a whole line of people going down the block.
It sold out very, very quickly.
I mean, we're talking 3, 4, 5 blocks. And it wasn't just single file. It was 3 or 4 deep.
There was as many people, if not more, standing outside the gig than there were in the gig.
Well, Jeff immediately sent me out for roses. So I got like 50, 60 roses, and he passed them out to everybody in the audience.
I suddenly wondered whether we could do another show.
Well, Emma Banks said, I'm going to leave. This was about halfway through the set. I'm going to go down and book another show.
The Old Forge, I mean, it was literally 10 minutes, 5 minutes away. Went up there, walked in to a completely empty venue, and I went up to them and I said, I've got an artist that has sold out down the road, and he would sell out again here tonight. Would it be possible for us to play here? And then it was pretty much like Pied Piper. Walked up Charing Cross Road with just a whole bunch of people behind me as we did a little procession.
We walked exactly this route up to the 12 Bar Club. When we turned onto Denmark Street following Jeff and Emma, of course, this is like the hub of English creativity back in the day. And it wasn't lost on Jeff, of course, because
He was carrying his own guitar, his Fender Strat. But of course, he was very distracted by all the guitar shops and everything in the window.
Everyone went in. Jeff set up, said, "I love it. It's a really great space." And Jeff started playing and pretty much didn't stop.
Jeff, because he just loved to play, just kept playing, just kept playing, just kept playing, just kept playing.
It was one of those remarkable gigs that goes down in folklore, I suppose.
You knew sitting there that you were actually witnessing history.
I've never done it again, but I've probably never had another artist that's like Jeff Buckley, so sometimes things really are a one-off.
This is my first visit back to the balcony of the 12 Bar Club. The balcony is really rickety. You've got inscriptions on the wood beams, the Forge, which was the name of the club before it became the 12 Bar. He played for about 2 hours, and amazingly, he didn't play a single song that he'd played down at Bungie's earlier. Jeff, for the first time, to me, showed what I would unreservedly call genius, especially in rock terms. He went from Black Dog by Led Zeppelin, fantastic version of Musty Musty by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and then he really dropped down and he did the most amazing version, and it's the first time I ever heard him sing it, of Satisfied Mind, a great Mahalia Jackson song. The last couple of lines actually became quite prophetic, of course, eventually, and the song was played as the last part of his funeral in Brooklyn.
Mostly it's an independent life. It's a very independent life, and it's a life that demands that you be open and demands that you take responsibility, you know, or suffer the hazards.
But when my life is over and my time has run out, my friends and my lovers I will leave, there's no doubt. But one thing's for certain, when it comes my time, I'll leave this old world with a satisfied mind.
In Los Angeles, when Jeff was doing his solo tour, this was about a week and a half in, I had a lung collapse. And I remember Jeff coming up to the hospital. He was white as a ghost. He walked in to my hospital room. And I asked him what was wrong. And he said, "Are you going to leave me too?" I said, "What do you mean, leave you too?" And I'm just remembering this now. He said, "Everybody in my life leaves me."
He had a vulnerability about him and an honesty about him.
That made you want to take and cradle him and protect him even more.
He was complicated and troubled a lot of the time and unhappy some of the time. And it's weird because it wasn't really very long a time that I knew him, but it feels like it was forever.
Music exists by itself. Music isn't really mine. Just like, you know, the air isn't mine. I don't own it. It's free. And the people have a direct relationship with it. To the extent that they're open to it, it can flow through them and help them or hurt them.
The phone rang at 6:30 in my room, and I'm a pretty sound sleeper. And it was my assistant, Jack Bookbinder, who said he's missing. And I said, "Who's missing?" He said, "Jeff's missing in the Mississippi River. We think he drowned."
And then, yeah, the bombshell hit. Oh, it was awful. It was absolutely awful. I mean, I could cry now just thinking about it. I really could.
So we did a press release saying he died, drowned, got a quote from his mom, sent the band home because the press was just all over the house. Time Magazine, Newsweek. You know, this was going beyond music. You know, the big story of Jeff dies of drug overdose like Tim is all flying around.
You know, we had so many plans, and he had so many plans, and he seemed to be in a good place. You know, we'd sort of had a conversation that maybe I'd go over a few weeks later and listen to some music, hang out, whatever.
I then went to the river for the first time. Been there a couple of days, went to the river with Keith Fodey, and I said, "Walk me through what happened." Told me I went out into the river, tugboat came by, he went under, then another tugboat went by, and then he never saw him again. And I said, "Give me 15 minutes. I sat there and bawled like a baby for 15 minutes. And then I got mad at him for leaving me with that pile of shit.
It's not an easy way to lose somebody, and it's hard to believe that it happened.
I'm blessed to have worked with him. And it went away too soon.
The Grace of Jeff Buckley was produced by Alan Hall for Falling Tree Productions and BBC Radio 4. Check out our website, thirdcoastfestival.org, to hear lots of additional work by Alan Hall, plus thousands of other great audio stories for your listening pleasure. Coming up after the break, the music of Ellie Stone, the tremulous singer now in her 80s. Stay with us. Welcome back to ReSound from the Third Coast Festival. I'm Gwen Macsai. Today,
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today we're listening to musician portraits by the British producer Alan Hall. Now, to me, Ellie Stone's voice is like a stream of clear water just floating by.
I loved all games.
She began her career in the 50s and was best known for her role in the original cast of Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, which began off-Broadway in 1968 and went on to Broadway, television, and film. When I was growing up, we played that LP often in my house and went to see the show when it came through Chicago in the early 70s. I'd never heard music like Brel's or heard a voice like Ellie's. Now I'm only too happy to be reunited with her crystalline sound.
Hi. Hello. I hope you weren't getting too anxious.
Alan.
Hi, I know. I'm sorry, but there was a delay in the train.
The voices of Ellie Stone.
I'm Noriko, the recording engineer here.
This Welcome is a story from off-Broadway.
Do they have coffee?
Would you like to, yeah, have you got coffee?
Broadway, 40 years ago.
Oh, that's wonderful. You don't have soy milk, do you?
It's a story shared between the singer, Ellie Stone, and the songs of Jacques Brel.
Just see how it is. And then the idea will be ultimately to cut it in with, you know, musical illustration and just to kind of build a picture of you and Brel.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
A life in song.
I really feel like I'm back in the business again.
And it's a story shared also with listeners like me who fell under the spell of a most distinctive voice.
You really want me to get that close?
Yes.
The tremulous voice of Ellie Stone.
closer you are, the more thank sympathetic you'll be, the more people will love you.
The what? The closer I am?
Yeah, the closer, the more sympathetic you'll sound. Yeah.
Oh, in other words, the more distant I am, the more distant I sound.
Yeah. So we want to be...
All right.
We want to be close to you. Are you running?
I'm Ellie Stone. I was a singer. I'm part of the continuum of showbiz. I'm going to be 88. And I was happy to get out of it. I was in my late 60s when I decided that was the end of it. My mid-60s, actually. But no, I was happy to not sing.
The old folks don't talk much.
The old folks don't talk much. And they talk so slowly when they do. They are rich, they are poor. Their illusions are gone. They share one heart for two. Their homes all smell of time, of old photographs and an old-fashioned song. Though you may live in town, you live so far away when you've lived too long, etc.
The old folks never die. They just put down their heads and go to sleep one day. They hold each other's hand like children in the dark. But one will get lost anyway.
Old folks... For me, I felt that as an actor, the only way I could approach that was just very coldly. To put pity into it would be awful, and this is really where one can miss on that one.
You'll see them when they walk through the sun-filled parks where children run and play. It hurts too much to smile. It hurts too much, but life goes on for still another day. As they try to escape the old silver clock, when day is through, it tick-tocks oh so slow. It says yes, it says no, it says I'll wait for you.
Well, it's a very wrenching song, but it has to be, it's only wrenching if it's done coldly. Otherwise, you can die of treacle poisoning.
That waits for us
all. My father, when he came to see it, he said, I never want to see the show again. Old folks just depressed me very, very much. Singing, I think, was probably the only place where I was able to express my feelings. I was very, very tied up, very... people used to call me alienated. But that was the only place where I could open my heart. My singing was truthful. I mean, this is what I like to think. I was always trying to be truthful in my singing. I asked my husband, Eric Blau, what people saw when I stood on stage, what they responded to, because I had no idea. And he said triumphal desperation.
So my childhood goes on the wind of the silence of memory's treason, the true make-believe. Winter snow made of diamonds on the windowsill.
And yes, I was desperate most of my life. And, you know, I felt I was always falling apart, but I did forge ahead.
So I could play half nude. Pony of gold.
So my childhood goes in the steam of the cooking. I dream of Charlotte Russe's and other truths.
And now my childhood, I don't know what to say about my childhood. It's so heartrending. I mean, I was reliving that loneliness, that sense of total alienation from everything around you, that sense of powerlessness.
So I block off my head, I pretend I'm a bird that's unseen and unheard. I have not said a word. I might ride a train.
You can't talk about a song, you have to hear it.
It's bedtime again.
I was just a mess. I'm not going to go into my childhood. I could talk about singing forever. Not about me, but I could talk about singing.
Can we just go back? Could you define the kind of voice that you realized that you had?
I had a voice that was much more mature than I thought I should have for my age. I was a little embarrassed by it. When I was young, it's almost as if I had big bosoms at the age of 10, which I didn't, of course. But that's the way the voice sounded to me. That's the way I perceived it. And at that age, I really wanted to be, for the rest of my life, a Wagnerian. And never made it to Wagnerianhood. At the age of 13, it had developed into a coloratura, not even a lyric coloratura. So it developed into the smallest of voices, the smallest of instruments. So at the age of 13, in my junior high, I wanted to try out for the High School of Music and Art. I was in the chorus, and the music teacher there took me home to her sister, who was a voice teacher, and she took me home to Lillian Strongen, who then became my voice teacher. And she was my teacher, and she was more than my teacher. She was my mentor. She's the most important person in my life. She gave me the kind of unconditional acceptance that many kids never get, and I didn't get it as a kid.
A childhood explodes.
Everything up until the age of 17 was in Brooklyn. After 17, my life was Manhattan and the world.
There was the first boy that I knew, and the first touch of flesh. It was life, it was life.
I got married at 17 and got divorced shortly after. I know it sounds funny, but I just wanted to get out of the house. In those days, it was kind of glamorous to be a divorcee. So I said, if I get married, then I can get divorced and I'll be glamorous. I mean, remember, the movies were full of glamorous divorcees.
So, Eric Blau, the poet, was your second husband?
Yes.
I'm Marique, Marique, the Flanders sun burns the sky since you are gone. I'm Marique, Marique, in Flanders field the poppies die.
When Eric was translating Marika, it was my idea that we keep the chorus in Flemish. It just rolled off the tongue so. It just seemed right.
Zonder liefde, warm liefde, light het licht, het donker. Funker Licht entzürt die Sonne über mein Land, mein Platteland, mein Flanderland.
And there was something so big about it, you know, that something so large that I felt that keeping it in the original language kept the mystery that I felt it had.
Marie, Marie, the Flanders moon won't light your way, the day is gone.
It's about love. It's about love and loss, which most songs are about. But there's love and loss, and there's love and loss. And the size of the love and loss really has to always to do with the talent of the artist, the composer, lyricist.
Mein Platteland, mein Flandernland, ei, Marieke, Marieke, the bells have rung, the echoes sound, the day is gone. Ei, Marieke, Marieke, in Flanders field, the echoes sound, the day is gone.
My early career, nobody broke down the doors. I have to say that I was not a careerist, really. I was always ambivalent about ambition. I was always ambivalent about music, always ambivalent about singing. So I never really pursued it. In a sense, it pursued me. And people were always intrigued with my voice, but they never knew what to do with me commercially. My voice didn't fit anywhere. But it was... It did capture people's imagination.
Timid Frida, will they greet her on the street where young strangers travel on magic carpets floating lightly in beaded caravans?
I was always timid. I was the most timid person in the world. I was... so shy that I couldn't even look at anybody straight in the eye. I was unbelievably shy. I'm shy!
Frida won't return now to the home where they do not need her, but always feed her little lessons and platitudes from cans.
You had a singing teacher who was important in your life. Eric.
Yes.
Clearly important figure in your life.
Yes, yes.
Jacques Brel.
Yes.
Where does he come in?
Eric had a friend at Columbia Records. His name was Nat Shapiro, and he was the head of International A&R. And we were up visiting him at one point, and he played Brel for us. And I went ape, and I said... Eric, and Eric was a poet, you know. And I said, Eric, would you please translate some of these lyrics for me? And he did. And then we met Mort Schumann. He wrote The Last Dance for me. He was also crazy about Brel, because Mort had gone to Paris long before and got to know Brel. I mean, he sort of kneeled at the shrine. These were songs that had so much meat in them. There is not a song that is not about something that is very crucial to life. And he was also, he had a very jaundiced eye. And he spoke on so much, on hypocrisy, on venality, on vanity, on all these things. I find it very hard to discuss some what's great in something that's great. It's like trying to punch a cloud. You can't. It's very hard for me anyway. And Eric and Mort and I decided that somehow this body of music must reach the American public. And then we decided the only way to do it is to turn it into, to take this body of work, turn it into a show. And in those days, there was word about Hitler. And they were saying Hitler's alive and well and living in Argentina, or Hitler's alive and well and living there, et cetera, et cetera. So, well, Jacques Brel's alive and well and living in Paris. And that's how the Brel show came about.
Fantastic. We need to stop now here.
Okay.
Can we go for tea?
Yes.
You are magnificent.
Oh, thank you. I'm so unused to being interviewed.
This is my last supper. Please come and eat with me. I want all my old friends.
There we are. And then we're in Sardi's.
Last supper. Make reservations, please. You'll all know one another, except blacks and Chinese.
Isn't this nice? And no, I'm not up on those walls. I am not a Broadway legend. Anyway, in those days, of course, they would seat you. The bigger you were, the further front you'd want to be, so that you could be seen. You could see people as they came in, and they could see you. But I always asked for the back. I wanted to be alone. I really wanted to be with my friends. That was about it. And I would meet people for lunch here, and it was very nice. Oh, thank you. That's very nice. What is that?
Crab cake.
Oh, good. Okay.
So powerlessness. Finish the thought. Just that. Thought.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's so. I lived with wall to wall anxiety. I lived really. My life revolved around a fulcrum of anxiety, and that was it. And I never even knew that because I was always anxious. So how do you know what it means to not be anxious? It's very good. It's a crab cake. I didn't know what he was telling me, frankly. I said, I want something light, but... And he said something. I didn't understand his accent, but it's good.
Higher above the ground, down again around, and up again around. So high above the ground, if you get a yell, we're in a carousel, a crazy carousel, we're on a Ferris wheel.
Here I am, back in the studio.
Down again around, and up again around, and up again around. So high above the ground, we feel we get a yell, we're in a carousel, a crazy carousel, we're in a carousel, a crazy carousel. And now we go around, again we go around, and now we spin around, high above the ground, and down again around, and up again around. So high above the ground, we feel we get a yell, we're in a carousel, a crazy carousel. Carnivals and cotton candies, carousels and calliopes, cupidals with painted faces, tricky shell games and missing feet.
It was called La Valse à Mille Temps, the Waltz of a Thousand Beats. Brel wrote it as a commentary on, he was a Belgian, and life there. You grow up, and this is what middle-class life is like, and it goes crazier and crazier and crazier. And Eric, he managed to create that sense of the craziness of life through the medium of the carnival and what happens to life. That starts out innocently enough and then ends up with insanity. I was 58, and I was, speaking of desperate, I was walking down Broadway and saying, I'm going to now wish myself to die. And I had done that many, many times in the past, but this time I really meant it. And I got scared because I felt something click. I felt I'd set something into motion, and I felt something click. And then I realized I had to do something. So that weekend, I did an LSD therapy session. And that was the beginning of who I am now. I would say that was, you know, when I did my first session, actually the first session was not LSD, it was MDMA. Are we legal here? MDMA, what they call ecstasy. And was the best thing that ever happened to me.
In spite of all, we're still together. So many years of smiles and tears.
In spite of all, we're still together. So many years of smiles and tears. How many times we'd part forever, and I would leave for parts unknown. A day, a week, and I'd feel terror and crumble on the telephone. Then in bed we'd play confessions and tell the truth what truth we knew. That's how it's been with me and you. Then start upon a new digression. That's one of the songs where Jacques said that Eric bested him. Those lyrics were, he felt superior to his.
My sweet, my old, my gentle love, from year to year as all the seasons fall, I love you more, you know, I love you. In spite of all, still together, so many years of smiles and tears. How many times I found another, but you loved others too, my dear. A day, a week, and I'd need pardon and fumble out the key to home and take a wound that went unhealing. For you'd forgive without forgiving, but of course we went on living, our sorrows locked in Christmas seals.
Oh, my love,
my love,
my sweet, my oh, my gentle love. From year to year, as all the seasons fall, I love you more, you know, I love you.
Oh, sorry. Oh. Thank you so much for just bearing with me. And
you know...
excuse me.
What happens when you get old is that... What happens when you get old is you have nothing to lose anyway. So. All right.
You sounded great.
Good. All right. Let's see. Let's go that way. It goes uptown.
Yeah. So this is your city.
This is my city. Born and dragged up here. Okay. Can you take us to, let's say, Broadway and 44th? We can get off at 43rd. How's
43rd
that?
43rd and Broadway.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, wait a second. This doesn't want to turn off. I wanted to turn it off. I guess we can't. We can't. That is a great song for all of us, isn't it? I love the last one, you know, the last one. And sometimes we were almost happy, and sometimes we would almost touch. I think we... And sometimes we were almost... happy, and someone we would almost touch. I think we wanted very little, but that always seemed too much. And did we say we wanted children? I really cannot quite recall. Yeah, what we wanted was a freedom to laugh, to dance, to have a ball.
And sometimes we were almost and sometimes we would almost touch.
Eric was quite an interesting poet.
I think we wanted faith.
I think his poetry was the best of his writing.
But that always seemed too much.
Anyway, dear.
And did we say we wanted children? I really
And did we say we wanted children? I really cannot quite recall. What we wanted was our freedom. To dance through life. To have a ball.
To dance through life, I think that's all.
We are just surrealist pilgrims melting clocks in marble halls. I'm still touched by those lines.
The Voices of Ellie Stone, produced by Alan Hall for Falling Tree Productions and BBC Radio 4.
I love you more, you know. I love you still.
The Voices of Ellie Stone won the prestigious 2015 Pre-Europa Award for Best European Radio Music Program. Congratulations, Alan. For links to more of his work or music by Ellie Stone and Jeff Buckley, who we featured in the first half of the hour, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. You've been listening to ReSound from the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program is produced by Dennis Funk and curated by Johanna Zorn and Sarah Geis of the Third Coast Festival. You can hear today's program at thirdcoastfestival.org, where you can also hear more than 1,500 outstanding documentaries from around the world and subscribe to our podcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Special thanks to our many individual contributors from Chicago and around the world. The Third Coast Festival, now an independent arts organization, was originally founded at WBEZ Chicago. ReSound returns next week with more radio that you can't hear anywhere else unless you live everywhere else.
You've been listening to the Third Coast Podcast. If you like what you heard today, leave us a review on iTunes, send us an email, or let us know through Facebook or Twitter. You can also support us with a donation at thirdcoastfestival.org. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.